President Trump bars refugees and citizens of 7 Muslim countries from entering the U.S. President Trump nominates Neil Gorsuch for U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Senate confirms Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Just some of the headlines that we will discuss in this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. What issue in the news would you like us to discuss? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We have with us two guests from different perspectives, and let me welcome them now. Keene Winters is a small business owner from Schofield and the coordinator of the Center-Right Coalition of Wausau. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Good to have you back. Jenny Dye is the research director for One Wisconsin Now and a Dane County supervisor. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. So I'm going to start with last Friday. Where President Trump signed an executive order suspending or at least temporarily banning refugee resettlement and entry into the U.S. And this affected primarily 7 Muslim countries. The move prompted mass confusion, protests, court cases, much more. It has certainly been perhaps the hottest topic of discussion for most of the last week. Jenny, starting with you, your reaction to this executive order and the reaction?
Well, I think the executive order is incredibly problematic. I mean, first of all, it is hurting a lot of people directly, including people who are American citizens, including people who we have already vetted and have given green cards to, and people who have already been through this process that is really in-depth to make sure that we are vetting the people that we let into this country. And, I mean, for example, there's a four-month-old baby girl whose grandparents are American citizens who is currently in Iran and was scheduled for heart surgery, and she was denied entry to the U.S. to get that surgery. It's just absolutely ridiculous. This isn't about keeping us safe. And in fact, experts are saying this may be making us less safe because terrorists are celebrating this policy as an opportunity to turn more people against the United States.
Keene, is this going to make us safer or less safe?
I think it's going to make us safer, and I think we're going to get the bugs worked out of it pretty soon. But in practice, this is what President Obama did in 2014 with Iraqi refugees. We had a pause there, including many interpreters. And in truth, we haven't been taking many Syrian refugees. In 2011, we took 29. In 2012, we took 31. In 13, 36. In 14, 105. And 15, 1682. But then, for fiscal 16, Obama opened the door to 13,000. We haven't gotten the actual number yet, but for all of Obama's presidency except the very end, he kept a tight lid on these things, too. And I think we're just going to have to do that.
Any response to that, Jenny?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's just not true that this is the same thing that was done under the Obama administration. The Obama administration did put into place stronger vetting at certain points when there were specific threats that caused them to do so, and that is appropriate. But we're talking about a policy that was just a blanket ban on specific countries that have a very high population of Muslims, and the way that it's been implemented has looped up tons of other people who truly are not security threats, including the former Prime Minister of Norway. I mean, we really, truly are seeing not just the intolerance of the Trump administration, but the incompetence with this.
Let me take a call from Jeff in Medford on this topic. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Well, thank you for having me.
Go ahead,
Hello?
Jeff.
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to comment on a couple of things. I've been listening to NPR, and this particular subject with the ban, my understanding is that these countries were already predetermined by the prior administration, and all the Trump administration is doing is continuing something that was already in progress. And that leads to the second concern, is that NPR typically says things of assumptive language or leaves out information that I consider important, but if people don't know about it, it seems to lead a perspective or an objective that may not be quite true, in this case regarding Trump.
All right, Jeff. Jenny, the NPR's language aside, these are seven countries that were picked by the Obama administration, and this would have happened under the Obama administration?
What Obama did do is, in his administration, the State Department did slow issuance of entrance to the country to Iraqi applicants, and in other cases, in response to specific threats. However, we've heard from this administration that this isn't in response to a specific threat. These aren't countries that were identified by President Obama, and in fact, there are countries that terrorists have come from that have hurt American citizens, including Saudi Arabia, who aren't on the list. And so this really isn't about keeping our country safe. It's about how can we ban Muslims from entering this country. Rudy Giuliani went on television and said that the Trump administration was trying to find a way to legally implement a Muslim ban, and the way that they have done that is to make it about countries instead of religion. But at its heart, it's still about discriminating against people of Muslim faith, and that is not what America is about.
Keen?
Well, certainly, if you were going to discriminate against people of Muslim faith, you would have to include countries like Indonesia, which are majority Muslim. You would have to include countries like Pakistan. And to be honest, we don't know what the specific intelligence is about who's about to infiltrate. Certainly, to have a ban for Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, that's pretty reasonable to me. And so it's not a blanket ban. It's seven Muslim countries. It's not all Muslim countries. So it's certainly there are Muslims coming and going every day.
Let me go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. And, sir, I think it's ironic that you call it reasonable. It's quite frankly up in Wausau. You know, some of us live with these people. We have, you know, Lebanese neighbors. We've dined with Pakistani people. And I just think you should be ashamed of yourself, quite frankly. And I want to know why the Trump administration has excluded these people. And a lot of evidence is pointed to the fact that he has business dealings in these countries. So, you know, either go all in or not. But I really think you should be ashamed of yourself.
Well,
it's really easy for you to say. Thank you very much.
Well, I don't mean to have any kind of, you know, personal attacks against anyone on the show here. But, Keen, what about the allegations that Trump excluded countries where he had business dealings? And, or, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're hurting our communities and our neighbors, frankly.
I don't know. I do think it's early in their process. They do not have their full cabinet in place. So I think they're, granted, it was ham-handed in some of the ways that it was implemented. But, again, I have to show some deference. I don't see the intelligence. I don't know, the stuff about his business dealings. Again, that's rank speculation. Some people have something more solid. This is it's seven countries who are clearly problematic, and in that sense, I think it's reasonable. It's not all Muslims. It's not a religious, but we also have to start making our borders more secure.
Well, let me ask you, Jenny. The President Trump is saying that he just wants to make sure there is he wants extreme vetting to be done before more refugees come into this country, that he is just trying to make sure that we keep America safe. What is wrong with examining temporarily our vetting process and making sure we have strong, a strong process in place before we resume accepting refugees?
Well, we already do have a strong process in place. It takes 2 years to be vetted as a refugee. In fact, the process for being vetted as a refugee is the most extreme vetting that we have and is incredibly in-depth. And so right now we're rejecting people who have already gone through that process. If President Trump wants to take a look at the vetting process and see if he wants to make any changes, that's certainly something that he can do. But he should do it with the involvement of the State Department and Homeland Security and through a thorough and carefully considered process, not in the first, 10 days of his presidency, without actually targeting this to the individuals who may be a threat to the United States. Instead, we've got babies, five-year-old children, grandparents who are all wrapped up in this, who are in some cases trying to get life-saving care. That's not the American way. That's not American values. And we are sending the wrong message, not just to the people trying to enter the country, but the world with the way that this has been implemented.
Jeremy in Superior is with us. Hi, Jeremy.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the point, one of your previous callers, is, in my opinion, is completely wrong, because it's not a ban on Muslims in any way. What it is trying to stop the terrorist activities that are prevalent and coming out of those seven countries.
And I'm sorry, just because we kind of touched on this a few times here, but Jenny, what about that? This is not a Muslim ban. It's just to make sure a potential terrorist doesn't come to this country.
Sure. Well, again, we already had a vetting process in place that was intended to prevent that and was successfully doing so. Secondly, we know that Rudy Giuliani went on TV and said that this was an effort by the Trump administration, that he had been told directly, how do you do a legal Muslim ban, and that this was their workaround for that. When people tell you what their intent is, you should believe them.
Yeah. Keane, do you want to react?
Well, we've had problems with Somali refugees over in Minneapolis. We've had also another Somali refugee go on a rampage at Ohio State. So there are certainly examples. And the question, so we're really arguing about whether we want to be preemptive and safe or we want to take some chances. And I think it's better to be safe. And again, we should show some deference to the administration that has its pulse on the intelligence about who's trying to come in and from where.
Grayson in the Upper Peninsula is with us now. Hi, Grayson.
Good morning, ma'am. Thanks so much for taking my call. I'd just like to throw a different twist on this. I'm a graduate of the Air Force Academy, and one of my classmates, in fact, at one time was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. When this ban came out, I thought, I guess my first impression was, well, how can it be so foolishly done? And then I thought they must be creating a smokescreen for something else that's going on. And my biggest troubling development was the sort of moving of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of the National Security Agency sort of to a backbench position where they're coming to the National Security Council on invitation, while Mr. Bannon, who has no portfolio at all in government or national security, has moved to the forefront.
Yeah, what's the deal with that, Keane? Do you think that Bannon should be, have a seat at the table at the NSC?
Yes, again, I would defer to a brand new president to put together his team and someone who's been in business a long time to streamline processes. I've done work in government. I know how bureaucratic it can be. So they're going to determine on their flow of information. And boy, I mean, we're really down in the weeds in the day-to-day management of the Trump administration like we've never been with any other presidency.
Jenny, what do you think?
Well, I think that the example of what has happened with the NSC and removing the Joint Chiefs from those seats and instead giving those seats to political advisors is really troubling. And it goes to the heart of why this is not a response to intelligence. Because we know that between when he was elected in November and when he was sworn in, Trump was refusing intelligence briefings at times. He now is taking the Joint Chiefs out of their historical role on the National Security Council and putting political advisors in, which has not been done by the past presidents that we have had recently. We've had Bush administration advisors come out and say that they think that that's a bad idea because national security decisions should be based on security, not politics, and it should be based on intelligence, not politics. And instead, now we have political advisors sitting at the table in that room, and that's really troubling. It should be troubling for every American because our safety should come before politics.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives on the top issues in the news this week. Sorry about that. We are talking with Jenny Dye, the research director for One Wisconsin Now and a Dane County supervisor, and Keen Winters, a small business owner from Schofield and the coordinator of the Center-Right Coalition of Wausau. And we will move on to some other issues, including President Trump's dealings with two other world leaders, the Mexican president and Australia's prime minister. And we will welcome the other issues you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Jenny Dye and Keen Winters today about the top stories in the news internationally, nationally, and here in the state of Wisconsin. We need to move on from topic to topic as there are a lot of news happening this week. So if you want to join in, you have to call in right away. Let's talk a little bit about the President Trump's private phone conversations with a couple of foreign leaders this week. They were described as contentious and combative. He reportedly clashed with both the president of Mexico, said something about sending in the troops because you have some bad hombres down there. And he also clashed with Australia's prime minister over a previous agreement that the U.S. was going to take in some refugees that are in Australia. However, an update, the Australian prime minister did tell an interviewer that President Trump did not hang up on him, as previously reported, that the phone call ended courteously. In any case, when President Trump was at yesterday's National Prayer Breakfast, he told the attendees, "When you hear about the tough phone calls I'm having, don't worry about it." So, Jenny, are you worrying about this?
I am. We have a president who, in week one, has chosen to pick fights with our allies and is allying with countries like Russia that we have historically had rough relationships with and who there are a lot of questions about their involvement in our latest election. That's very concerning. And, I mean, I suppose threats to Mexico are one way to make Mexico wish there was a wall, but that's not how we should be conducting diplomacy. And, I mean, in the case of the Australian prime minister, it's great that apparently he didn't hang up on the prime minister, but the rest of that phone call that we've heard reported out is also very concerning when they were on the phone. The content of the call, calling deals dumb. He then went on Twitter and referred to refugees as illegal immigrants, like just either clearly ignoring or not understanding foreign policy. And that is really concerning because this is a guy who has nuclear codes. It's on him to actually engage in diplomacy with our foreign countries. And it might be not such a big deal when it's Mexico or it's Australia that we have had a working relationship with. But what happens when we're actually in a crisis and the president is too tired to be polite on a phone call?
Let's turn down the sirens in the back of Jenny's phone call. Keen, what's your reaction to
this? Well, I feel for Jenny. I think it'll be a long 4 years. If she chooses to believe all the spin, she won't sleep a wink. But look, you've had the Australian prime minister come and say, look, pieces that were reported are simply not true. Yesterday I happened to catch an interview with the Mexican ambassador and Anderson Cooper on CNN, and the Mexican ambassador was actually on the phone call and he went through item by item and denied many of the more salacious details that had been reported. I think it's extremely troubling that the President of the United States has phone calls with foreign leaders that members of really the bureaucracy are leaking to the press, mischaracterizing and spinning. That ought to be our biggest concern, is that when is the last time you've heard the details of a president's call? Those should be private calls, and we should have a staff and a bureaucracy that isn't engaged in this kind of subversion. And who can believe, by the time it goes from people who are intent on subversion to people in the press who are intent on subversion, it's hard for me to believe any of it, especially when I've seen the Mexican ambassador and now the Prime Minister of Australia walk back what have been widely reported salacious details.
Yeah. Let's go to Mike in Balsam Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, this great segue, those last comments, because, you know, the calls, when we talk about these calls, state leader to state leader, there's usually a few members of close staff that are on those calls. The bureaucracy is not on those calls. You know, these details that came out, especially on the Australian call, the White House provided pictures of who was there in the office when those calls were being made. And it was Ed Flynn, the National Security Counselor, or whatever his title is, and Bannon, and a couple other close aides. Now, these guys are the ones that leaked the information out. They're the ones that were on the call. This was not, they didn't have some low-level bureaucrat on these calls. Now, how is this important? The importance on this is that we have to remember that they downgraded the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they downgraded the head of the overall intelligence agencies from the National Security Council to be optional. Yet these are the guys that would have sat in that call, and I would hope that they would challenge the president and let him know that Australia is one of our staunchest military and intelligence partners in that area of the world, and talking the way he's talking to them is a diss.
Thank you, Mike. Because now, so Keen, again, and we have another caller who wants to focus on that the Australian president says he was not hung up on. Okay, we have reported that the Australian president says that he was not hung up on. But what about the dumb deal and accepting the refugees from Australia that was the bone of contention in that phone call and discussed after that phone call?
Well, certainly, you know, the Obama administration set him up for this by leaning on Australia to take the refugees with the promise that we'd take them. I don't know if he said dumb deal or not, and your previous caller is a little bit misinformed about the process. Yes, there are a few people in the room, but these calls are recorded, then they're sent to places to be transcribed, and they're circulated among senior staff on a much wider basis, senior staff at State Department and other places. So and it's the people who do the transcribing, it's the people who do the circulating. Those are the people who are really the sources of the leak. At least that's what David Gergen identified on CNN.
Yeah. Well, I guess I thought that Donald Trump, in his own words, in a tweet, called it a dumb deal. Jenny?
He in fact did, and I think that really goes to the heart of the matter. This isn't a case of the media misreporting what happened. Certainly, we can agree the Australian Prime Minister has said that they did not hang up the phone on him. But everything that happened before that was still a problem, where the call was contentious. There was this conversation in which we called a negotiated deal a, quote, dumb deal, and then we went on Twitter and said that. And while it's true that the Australian Prime Minister has walked back the hang-up, the rest of his comments were surprising diplomatic, and that's something that we are really missing from our president in his discussions about foreign leaders. The Australian Prime Minister was asked about Trump and if he was a brash character, and he refused to comment on that, saying he's clearly a big personality, but he would leave the rest to others to comment on. Trump is never going to leave anything for anyone else to comment on. He is number one out there, ready to comment on everything, whether it's a good idea for our foreign policy or not, and ready to reduce it to 140 characters on Twitter. And that just is not how we should be conducting foreign policy. It's not how we should be conducting domestic policy, and it's not how we should expect our president to conduct himself.
You know, I mentioned that at that prayer breakfast, President Trump said, don't worry about the tough phone calls that he had. He also, at that prayer breakfast, joked that those in attendance should pray for Arnold Schwarzenegger so that his Celebrity Apprentice ratings go up. Trump says the show has gone down the tube since he left as host. Schwarzenegger responded on Twitter suggesting that the two switch jobs since Trump is such an expert on ratings, and that people will sleep comfortably again if Schwarzenegger were in the White House instead. Who got the better of that exchange, Keene?
Well, I suppose Arnold did. It was probably not the best, but, you know, people kid around a little bit, and I don't know if Arnold Schwarzenegger and Donald Trump are friends or not. But, yeah, it wasn't necessary. I suppose it was an attempt at humor, and it certainly fell flat.
Jenny?
Well, I will say that one of the things that I appreciated during the Obama administration was the president's sense of humor. So I'm not going to fault a president for making a joke that maybe doesn't go exactly as he would have planned. But what I will say is it's concerning how much attention the president seems to give to things like TV ratings and the Celebrity Apprentice instead of paying attention to the bigger picture of what we need to be doing for America, like paying attention to the details of how do you roll out a change in a vetting process for people trying to enter the country, or how do you engage in diplomacy with foreign leaders when you're on the phone with them. And if you put a little bit more effort into that and a little bit less effort into paying attention to what's going on with the Celebrity Apprentice, we would all be better off.
Charlie in Platteville is with us. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, good morning, and thanks for taking my call, and for the great show, and for both of your guests. I appreciate that. A couple of comments. We talk about Donald Trump being somebody who is doing things differently, and he's bringing some changes to the process of government. But different isn't necessarily good. And one of your guests mentioned that there's so much information that's being released, and I think it could be that some people on the inside are concerned with what's happening, that they may not have been concerned as much when other administrations were there, so they choose to release. And then my other analogy that I came up with was that Donald Trump doesn't have, as one of your guests just mentioned, doesn't seem to have the finesse, the diplomatic mind to deal with some of these issues that should be dealt with. But he's more like a bull in a china shop. But I would say he's more like a bully in a china shop.
Well, what's your reaction, Keene, to that?
Well, I think he comes from a different school. And but he's also, look, it's about negotiating deals to him. And he has a certain way that he goes about things, and that is staking out positions and then working his way back towards the middle. And that might be different than what we've done before. But I think he's been president exactly 2 weeks now. We really ought to give a chance to see how these things work out rather than, I can't believe that 2 weeks into his presidency we're in down in the weeds parsing the language that he used on phone calls with two foreign leaders when we've never talked about what should be private phone calls in the first place.
Jenny?
Well, being president isn't about making deals, and that's really part of the problem here, that we have a guy who does love to make a good deal, but historically, when he's done that in the business sector, if that deal failed, then he could run and file for bankruptcy with that company, or there were other ways to address that. This is America. We can't just make a deal and then, you know, pick up the pieces later if it falls apart. We need a long-term strategy, not just a guy who's hopping from deal to deal. And the sooner that President Trump and the Republican Congress, who also have a role to play in making sure that our government has some stability and a long-term strategy, get on that page, the better we all will be. Because whether I like it or not, Trump is going to be president for the next 4 years, and we need him to do a better job than he's done in these first 2 weeks.
Let's. I need to move on to some other big stories in the news this week. President Trump also announced the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. The 49-year-old federal appellate judge from Colorado is generally seen as conservative and much in the same vein as the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Keene, your thoughts on this pick?
Well, he was on the president's list of 20 people that he used during the campaign, so it's certainly fulfilling a campaign promise. It's certainly having won. I think he has a mandate to do this. And Mr. Gorsuch has a long record of, well, I think it's 850 decisions that he's written since 2006 on the 10th Circuit. He's also one of those judges who writes widely and speaks widely. So there's a volume of information about him, a great CV, you know, but at the end of the day, he is a textualist and comes from a person, that mentality where you follow the letter of the law and you don't make new law. And I'm happy with that. I don't know who wouldn't be.
Many Senate Democrats say they will oppose the confirmation of Gorsuch. Some leaders have openly questioned his credentials, and there's still some resentment among Democrats over Congress's inaction in holding hearings for Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's pick last year to fill this vacancy. Jenny, how do you expect this to play out, and do you think Democrats should try to block this nomination?
Well, I do, Joy, and I think for a number of reasons. First of all, I think there are a lot of questions about Trump's presidency, about our process, about how we're going to be doing business going forward. The Republican Senate really decided to break our process in terms of how this country approaches a Supreme Court vacancy last term, and now they're going to have to live with the consequences of that. And one consequence is that instead of seeing large support for justices who maybe are on one far side of the aisle or the other, like, in fact, Scalia himself, we now have a very partisan view on both sides of how do we review these justices. And in the case of Gorsuch, we have a very right-wing extreme record proposed by a president who did not even win a majority of the votes of Americans. And instead of coming into office and trying to put together a consensus pick, like Merrick Garland was, you know, more middle of the road, more mainstream, he chose to put forward someone who is a hard right extremist who has favored corporations over people, who has been hostile towards women's rights. Trump had promised that he would appoint someone to overturn Roe versus Wade, and to the point of, you know, who could possibly object to someone who's just going to apply the letter of the law? Literally no judge just applies the letter of the law. Every judge comes in and interprets the law. That's why we have judges. That literally is their job. And this is someone who, if he lives up to Trump's promise and what his record tells us, would vote to overturn Roe versus Wade should a case come before him. And that's concerning because Roe versus Wade also is law. Law comes from cases and it comes from legislation, and we should have someone who we know is going to continue to uphold the law and protect the rights of all Americans, not just those who happen to have elected Donald Trump.
Let me bring Joel and Kenosha in on this. Hi, Joel.
Hi there. You know, I obviously don't know enough about Justice Gorsuch at this point to guess. But, you know, give them a hearing. But the Democrats should stand firm if he is as right-wing and doctrinaire as he's been made up to be. They should vote against him and leave eight members on the court, just like the Republicans were more than willing to do if Secretary Clinton had become president.
Well, thank you, Joel. But Keene, you want to talk about the politics of all this?
There's been a tit for tat. We had Harry Reid use the nuclear option for appellate court judges, which means he got rid of the filibuster, and we've had Republicans delay because we were in an election year. That should be put to rest now. If the current Democratic Senate chooses to escalate one more time, then the Republicans are going to use the nuclear option, and we're going to be done with trying to get things done collegially. I mean, we had good collegial votes for people like Elena Kagan, you know, who got, 85 votes, even though she's clearly on the left side. We're talking about a person who is replacing Antonin Scalia. We're not changing the balance of the court. We're replacing Antonin Scalia with someone who follows Antonin Scalia. And you still have Justice Kennedy as the swing vote between the 4-4 conservative and liberal members. So, I find just the incredible amount of exaggeration and hyperbole out there. Trump deserves a chance to get his administration going, and I know Jenny's been talking about we got to get your act together. Well, we can't even get his nominees through the Senate for his staff and for his cabinet with this kind of contentiousness. How's he supposed to get organized?
We're going to talk more about some of those cabinet picks and confirmation process. In fact, we'll focus in on his nominee for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who cleared another hurdle early this morning. We'll pick up with this after our break, and we'll also talk about some issues making news in the state of Wisconsin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with two guests from different perspectives about the top stories in politics nationally and in the state of Wisconsin. Our guests today are Keene Winters, a small business owner from Schofield. He coordinates the Center-Right Coalition of Wausau. And Jenny Dye is the research director for One Wisconsin Now, also a Dane County supervisor. Well, as mentioned before a break, President Trump's choice for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos cleared another hurdle early this morning. A somewhat unusual 6:30 a.m. our time meeting was scheduled, and the Senate voted 52-48 along party lines to advance her to a full confirmation vote on Monday. However, two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, said this week they would not support her. So DeVos appears to be headed for a 50-50 tie, but then Vice President Mike Pence is likely to serve as the tiebreaker, and she is expected to win confirmation. Jenny, your reaction and briefly what her confirmation means for the future of education. Are you there, Jenny?
I am. Sorry about that. I think it's incredibly concerning. It's hard to imagine a worse person for this job. I mean, during her education hearing, she didn't know basic facts about education, like the difference between proficiency and growth. She plagiarized answers on her Senate questionnaire, setting a great example for school kids across the nation. And her agenda on education has been consistently to try to weaken public schools in favor of private voucher schools. And that's really concerning because public schools have always been the great equalizer in our nation. They're what open doors to opportunity for every single kid, and we should be trying to find somebody who's going to promote that and invest in it instead of somebody like Betsy DeVos, who has been systematically dismantling it.
Keen.
Well, I think she's going to bring greater deregulation for schools, and I think we need innovation. We need to try some of these new things. We just had an article in the Wall Street Journal this week about some of the aftermath of Act 10. There's been a new study by Stanford University. Some schools systems in Wisconsin chose to change and pay teachers individually, while others chose to stay with the old system and the pay grid, and that's given them data to compare the two, and it looks like the schools that have chosen to update and pay teachers individually are doing much better. And so that's the kind of thing, innovation, that I think we're going to see from Betsy DeVos, data-driven, and the opportunity to have alternative models of education. Certainly every child should get an education, but we can't just put all kids through the same system. Kids learn differently. There have to be options, and Betsy's going to be friendly to those options.
Margaret in Buchanan is with us. Hello, Margaret.
Hi. I just don't understand how she made it this far in the vetting situation, since she has absolutely no educational credentials behind her.
Well, she's a pro-voucher school and school choices where she excels, Margaret. So what about that experience?
What does that have to do with knowing how to run a school?
All right. What about that, Keen?
Well, I think that's been one of the deficiencies. People get locked into, well, I need someone with school credentials to run the school district, whereas I think someone with a good business education could actually run the organization and probably do it better. So schools tend to get too inbred with their own professionals, and I'd like to see someone with an outside perspective come in here and clean things up.
What do you think, Jenny?
I think that that's an incredibly offensive way to look at schools as a business model. Schools are not a business model. They are a public good, and they're about providing opportunities for every kid in America to succeed. This is a person who would be the first Secretary of Education who has never been a public school parent or student, and would be the Secretary of Education setting policy for public schools around the nation. That is appalling to me. Schools are not about making money. They're not about turning a profit. And in many ways, trying to turn a profit is antithetical to what we want from schools. We want schools to invest in kids and help every student graduate ready to succeed in the business place when they leave school. But that doesn't mean that you should be running your school like a business where you find ways to cut corners, decide what's worth investing in and what's not, because at the end of the day, Americans believe every kid is worth investing in, and we deserve a Secretary of Education who believes that too.
Let me go to Pat in Milwaukee. Keen, I'm sorry. Let me get Pat in Milwaukee on.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, again, like what Keen said, I just don't remember the kind of parsing and examination of all these appointees in the past. And I mean, to speak again to the hysteria and the fact that the Democrats still can't figure out what happened. I mean, this morning I heard Chuck Schumer wouldn't even meet with Neil Gorsuch yesterday. The phone calls is another example, and I'm glad we correct the record.
Yeah, and I don't have time to go back to the phone call now because we're almost out of time. I did want to, so Pat is saying that that the cabinet picks were kind of moving slower than usual because of hysteria from the left, and that the Democrats are bitter that Trump won, and Democrats did stage a boycott of the vote for two of Trump's top cabinet nominees this week, but then Republicans pushed ahead without them, suspending a committee rule that one Democrat be present to vote. That allowed Republicans on the Senate Finance Committee to unanimously approve Steve Mnuchin to be Secretary of the Treasury and Representative Tom Price to be Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. Those now head to the full Senate. Very briefly, Jenny, so Democrats, sour grapes, that's what this is all about.
Well, let's just make sure that we have an accurate picture of history. It took more than 160 days to confirm Loretta Lynch as Attorney General during the middle of President Obama's term. So we are nowhere near 160 days into President Trump's term. And so let's compare apples to apples. The delay that we're talking about here is just minuscule in comparison to what we saw last session. And that's something that our senators would do well to remember. When you change the rules of the game, you change them permanently. So Republicans don't get to obstruct, and then run around with their hair on fire when it happens to them. I think the other important piece of this is that the folks who have been put forward by the Trump administration are either supremely unqualified, like we've seen in the case of Betsy DeVos, have conflicts of interest and questions about their integrity, like Mnuchin and Price, who lied to the Senate during a confirmation process. And in the case of Jeff Sessions, are just completely intolerant and out of step with American values. Like, he was too racist to be confirmed in the 80s. And we're now having a debate in 2017 about confirming Jeff Sessions. That is why we see Democrats fighting these nominations, because it matters who is sitting in those seats, and the folks who have been put forward are really concerning for many Americans who deserve to have their rights protected and want to make sure that this country continues to succeed going forward, not just for 4 years of a Trump administration, but for the next, 400 years.
Yep. Keen?
Well, I think Jenny and the rest of the Democrats really imperil their future by engaging in the kind of hyperbole and name-calling. Let's, for example, compare apples to apples. For Representative Price, he's undergone 35 days of committee vetting. For previous H&HS secretaries like Kathleen Sebelius, it was 16 days, and for Sylvia Burwell, 17 days. He's gone. So if we're really comparing apples to apples, they've gone through twice as much vetting. But to say things like, oh, he's a racist, there's no proof of that. And you know, I guess if it's just like the protest at the Capitol for Act 10. Reasonable people are going to say, hey, we should just vote and get on with it. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. And the real foot-dragging, protesting, name-calling, it just goes beyond the pale, and most people, I think, particularly Republicans and independents, are going to look at that and say, it's just not right. We want a process that works. We want a process that has endpoints, and that process is voting and getting on. And these things like boycotts, missing meetings, engaged in delays, protests, I think are wearing thin on the general population.
Well, that's going to have to be last word, as we have run out of time for this edition of the Week in Review. Thanks very much to Keen Winters and Jenny Dye for being with us. We will get to state issues during our state capitol report coming up Monday from 7 until 8, where I know we will be previewing the state budget address, which will be delivered by Governor Walker on Wednesday at 4 o'clock. We will follow up all morning on Thursday morning. We will also, in our state capitol report, preview the state budget address, but we will also talk about Governor Walker's announcement on ways that he wants to benefit rural schools, his rural school improvement plan that he announced this week. So we'll talk about that in our state capitol report. We will be carrying the budget address live next Wednesday, and we'll follow up on Thursday morning. Thank you to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening. This is the Week in Review. This is the Ideas Network.